Good afternoon. Welcome to our second meeting of the season. We have a very interesting guest today, you'll hear. Some of you may have read about him. Please silence your cell phones if you would. This is a good time to remember that. I want to remind you that our next speaker is Michael Ramirez, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist who is now an associate editor with the Investor's Business Daily. I think that'll be December 12, over across the street in the River of Grass. You'll really enjoy that program, I promise. And now I'd like to introduce our invocation giver today, the Reverend Ted Sauter of the North Naples United Methodist Church.
It's a mixed blessing to pray today. I was going to do a Thanksgiving prayer, and I realized a lot of you aren't real thankful this time of year with a lot of things happening. And then I tried to find an appropriate prayer. They send us the background information on our guest speaker. And so I looked up about Senator Graham, and I was going to do a prayer for Republicans. It was on the same page of our prayer book for struggling minorities and endangered species. So I looked a little further. I found out he had gotten his doctorate at the University of Georgia. My son's a graduate of Florida. So they had a prayer for the Florida-Georgia game that I asked him to send to me. It didn't bother me that it began with Go Gators, but there were some other words in that prayer that Methodist ministers aren't to use in public where there's teenagers present. So I'll just use my own prayer today. So if you'll take a moment to be thankful with me. What a beautiful day we have. What a great location. A good fellowship of intelligent people who care about their country, their community, their world. We thank you for our guest speaker who's with us today, a man who's shown great wisdom and service throughout his lifetime. We thank you for this food and those who prepared it. Be with us that even in uncertain times, we can trust that you are one who provides for us, O God, values that last, that give strength and give hope. Be with us, we ask, in your name. Amen.
Now, before you get completely busy with your table mates, let me bring our first highlight of the program to you. Shelley Church will introduce our student guests.
Good afternoon, everybody. Obviously, we have a full house. This is great. I'm very excited, and I'm really excited about the students that we have with us today. I thought I'd take a minute. They're going to talk about themselves, so I'm not going to talk about them. So I just thought I'd share a little bit of information about Barron Collier High School, some interesting facts. First of all, Barron Collier High is an A-plus school in the last 5 of 6 years, which is terrific. The Barron Collier students are among the greatest number of college-bound students in the state and the largest enrollment of advanced placement courses in the county and state level. I thought that was very interesting. 57% achieve a 3 or better on the AP test, on the advanced placement test. Barron Collier is nationally ranked as in the top 1% of high schools in the United States in academics. I bet you a lot of you didn't know that. But Barron Collier was also ranked 464 out of 28,000 high schools in 2006 in the nation, which I thought was really very impressive. And I want just to take a minute to introduce the advisor who's with the students today, because the advisors, when they understand, do this on their own time. They do not get paid extra for doing this, and I think it's important because, first of all, Mrs. Kim Stahlkopf. Kim, would you please stand up for just a minute so I can introduce you? I just found out when Kim came to the reception, she actually graduated from Barron Collier High School. She looked like one of the students, so I had a hard time identifying. You know, it happens as we get older. Everybody looks younger. She's been teaching for 7 years. She teaches journalism, American history, and English honors. And she's also advisor for the Student Council, the school newspaper, and the school yearbook. She handpicked these six students, and they're all seniors, and you're going to be extremely impressed with each of them. Would you guys come up, and I'll let you each introduce yourselves and tell the group about each of you. We have Christina DiNardo, Eric Schmidt, Morgan Simpson, Austin Alberry, Gabrielle Barrett, and Corey Kubaki. Okay, did I get it? All right, great. And I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves because I know you'd rather hear from them than me.
Thank you, Ms. Church, for the introduction. And thank you to the Forum Club of Southwest Florida for having me and my fellow classmates here today. As you know, I am a senior at Barron Collier High and am now anticipating the next chapter of my life by applying to college. My two top choices of schools at the moment are Bentley University in Boston and Fordham University in New York City. Whichever school I end up attending, I see myself majoring in business, as I've always had an interest in marketing. This fact surprises many of my friends who know me as an actor. During my 4 years at Barron, I had passionately pursued theater and was privileged enough to serve as drama club president. My fellow thespians always say that they could see me on a stage, but picturing me behind a desk is a stretch. I explain to them that theater is not limited to the stage. It has taught me how to express myself, to listen and collaborate, and explore my strengths and weaknesses as a person. Whether an actor or a marketing executive, both are in the business of not only telling, but selling stories to an audience, whether that audience be in a theater or a demographic. No matter what role I ultimately play in life, I've always been confident in my range of character and my ability to overcome self-consciousness. As a young person filled with ambition but lacking experience, it is a great privilege to be here and listen to your stories, both the successes and the failures, and the lessons learned along the way. I will always remember this experience of having the pleasure to speak with the leading professionals of my own community, as well as I begin my own story of self-discovery in the business world. Thank you.
Good morning. It's such a privilege to be here to speaking with you all today. My name is Morgan Simpson, and I'm currently in my senior year at Barron Collier High School. I moved to Naples, Florida before my freshman year from Danbury, Connecticut. I currently carry a 4.38 GPA and have received academic excellence these past 3 years. I have also lettered in girls varsity soccer all 4 years. This is one of my favorite activities at Barron. Being a part of a team provides a platform on which to build my character, to be myself, build my strengths, and contribute my abilities to a group of my friends and my teammates. As the student body secretary on student council, I'm very involved in my school. I'm also very passionate about photography and have had a photo of mine displayed in the state art exhibition. I'm also an active member of the National Honor Society, participating in community service projects such as Habitat for Humanity, Adopt a Family, and tutoring. Being involved in such activities has been more rewarding than I could have ever imagined. Helping those less fortunate than myself has opened my eyes to others' disadvantages and motivates me to conquer any that lie ahead for me. I've recently been accepted to the University of South Florida, which I plan to attend next fall, and pursue my goal of becoming a physical therapist. This has been my dream for a number of years, starting when I suffered a serious ankle injury and had to attend physical therapy for 3 months. Seeing the therapist help not only people like me with slight injuries, but those with more severe disabilities inspired me to become a person that has a job dedicated to helping others. While I know accomplishing this dream will take a lot of hard work and perseverance, I'm determined to succeed. I appreciate the opportunity to be here speaking to all of you. It has been such an honor. Thank you for your time.
Once again, thank you for just inviting us to speak here in front of you guys. Thank you. According to Colin Powell, there are no secrets to success. It is the result of preparation, hard work, and learning from failure. Whether on the soccer field, during the school day, or in my personal life, I realize that my successes have largely been based upon working hard towards achieving my goals. As an athlete, I have spent countless hours practicing for soccer, triathlons, as well as cycling. For the last 4 years, I have played soccer for the Barron Collier High School Cougars and was co-captain for last year's squad. I have participated in numerous triathlons and always finished in the top 5 places. After 1 year of intense training and competitive road cycling, I became the Florida State champion in the Criterium Racing Circuit. As a student, I have focused on academics and challenged myself with college preparatory and advanced placement courses. Twice, I have been the recipient of academic excellence certificates while in high school. In May, I will be graduating in the top 10% of my class with a 4.8 GPA. I will continue to commit myself to education and push myself academically as I pursue a degree in medicine. As a person, I have always strived to make a difference in the lives of others. I have volunteered for the American Cancer Society, and this year was invited to be a member of the Relay for Life Planning Committee. At school, I try to make a positive impact wherever I go. While at Barron, I've had the honor of being recognized as Student of the Month 4 times, Student of the Week 2 times, and Student of the Year 1 in 2007. Confucius once said, "Study the past if you would define the future." Looking back, I realize that I have worked hard, met challenges, and overcome obstacles, and am proud to have earned these honors. Looking forward, I can only dream of where my hard work will take me and what is to come in my future. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Austin Alberry. I like to think of myself as a very active person. I'm very involved in many activities, including my 3 varsity sports, soccer, cross country, and track. And in the past 2 years, I've been named captain to each of those 3 teams. My favorite of the 3 sports, however, is soccer, definitely. Last year, I was named to the Class 5A All-State soccer team, so that helps me to definitely make that my main sport. More important than sports, however, I make sure that I excel in my academics as well. Over the last 3 years, I've done my best to challenge myself in school, taking 5 advanced placement classes over the last 2 years, in addition to the 2 that I'm currently enrolled in. Throughout these difficult classes, I've worked hard and struggled to stay ahead, and I currently have a 5.1 grade point average.
Make me look bad.
Thank you. Each year, to keep myself focused, my goal is to be invited to the Century Dinner at the end of each year that recognizes the top 25 in each class, a distinction that I've earned the past 2 years, and I hope to make it a third this year. I'm also a very active member in the Young Life Youth Group, where we meet each Monday night. And through that youth group, I found Campaigners, which is a Bible study where a few of my peers and I meet each Thursday after school. At this group, we do our best to try and give back to the community. We've helped out at St. Matthew's House, and we've also set up a Habitat for Humanity project that's coming up in December. Overall, I'd say I'm a very passionate person as well. In school, in sports, and in any other activity I commit myself to, I make sure I give it my best effort every time. I hope to carry this passion and my determination throughout college, and I hope to attend the University of Notre Dame, Florida State University, or another college in the state of Florida, where I plan to major in business. After college, my dream is to obtain a position in the front office of a professional sports franchise, where I know my passion will be a key to my success. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Gabrielle Barrett, and I'm so honored to be here amongst the community's most influential and respected citizens of Naples. I'd like to share my story with you. All of us have passions in our lives, but my one true passion in life is dance. I've been dancing for 10 years, and it's truly become a part of my soul. When I'm up on stage, no one can take anything away from me, and it feels as though I'm completely free of everything going against me. God's truly blessed me with a great gift. Another passion of mine is my religion and service. I've been attending my high school youth group and Young Life youth group for 4 years now, and have grown in my faith and passion for helping others. Every summer, I spend 2 weeks in Tijuana, Mexico, building houses for families who have absolutely nothing. The first time I went, it truly opened my eyes to the world and taught me about the foundation of faith, walls of strength, shelter of love, and the meaning of hope. We spent the 2 weeks building houses with just our hands, and at the end of the weeks, it was time to hand over the keys to the families. the feeling of gratitude that exuded from them, it was just overwhelming, and it changed me as a person forever. I've also applied these key objectives to my school life. I'm taking advanced placement college courses. I'm part of many clubs and organizations such as National Honor Society, Student Council, and FGCU Student Accountability Board. I've been Student of the Week 3 times, Student of the Month 2 times, and Arts Student of the Year. Throughout my 4 years of high school, I've strived to attain the respect of my fellow peers and have succeeded by winning Miss Baron Collier, Homecoming Queen, and Best All Around. As for my college plans, there's many on my list, such as University of Florida and Florida State University. However, my top choice and dream school would be Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Pending scholarship, that is. I plan on majoring in graphic design. I look forward to speaking with more of you today and hearing more about your stories and achievements. I can't wait to learn from you and apply the lessons learned to my life. I will always carry the benefits of this opportunity with me. Thank you again.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for letting me speak on this day. My name is Eric Schmidt, and I'm the senior class president. I play varsity basketball and very active in Key Club and Green Group. I was also elected Mr. Baron Collier. It's kind of like the head cheerleader. I like it. I don't know if you got it. These titles and activities give you a good sense of who I am and what I want to do with my life. Being class president teaches me responsibility. Basketball teaches me teamwork and commitment. Key Club and Green Group teach me how to give back to the community because it's given to me. Like many famous entrepreneurs, when I'm finished with college, I plan to find a need in the world and fill it. This summer, I was chosen from a pool of applicants to be a Junior Achievement CEO Entrepreneurship Academy at Florida Gulf Coast University, the Lutgert College of Business. I learned skills from that business, and it pretty much, you know, formed what I wanted to do with my life. I want to become an entrepreneur. This was the light bulb moment and showed me what I would be interested in. I believe God helps those who help themselves, and with my ambition, I plan to make a difference in the world. A very successful businessman in Naples once told me, "Smart people know everything, but smarter people know everyone." It's true. I plan to go to UF or FGCU because if you look outside, it's a nice day, and why would you want to leave Florida? My sense of character, ambition, responsibility, teamwork, and commitment will help me shape who I am and become a successful entrepreneur one day. Thank you.
What do you think? You think the future's secure? Enjoy your lunch. We'll be back at you in about 20 minutes. We're going to get started. I'm sorry that some of you are still waiting for food, but I'm sure you're getting close to getting it. Before we introduce the person who will introduce our guest speaker, let me first pay tribute to Ed Woolman, who sponsored our students today, and thank you very much. Ed, will you stand up? And now, with very brief introduction at her very emphatic request, I introduce Leslie Fogg, who is here representing her husband, Joe, who couldn't be here today, who was responsible for bringing our guest speaker. And Leslie is, I will say this, a little plug for Leslie. She's chair of the capital campaign for the Naples Botanical Garden, just in case any of you are so inclined. Leslie?
Thank you, Alan. Senator Graham is vice chairman of UBS, having joined the investment bank in 2002, after 24 years in Congress, including the last 18 years as senator from Texas. Phil Graham's legislative record as senator includes landmark bills like the Graham-Latta budgets, which reduced federal spending, rebuilt national defense, and mandated the Reagan tax cut. 2 years later, he passed the Graham-Rudman Act, which placed the first binding constraints on federal spending. As chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, he led the successful effort to restore a Republican majority in the Senate in 1994. My husband first met Phil while working to raise money for this effort. As chairman of the Banking Committee, Senator Graham steered through legislation modernizing the banking, insurance, and security laws, which had been languishing in Congress for 60 years. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Act repealed the 70-year-old Glass-Steagall Act, which prohibited banks, security firms, and insurance firms from affiliating. Phil Graham also authored key reforms of the U.S. welfare system and the Homeland Security Act. Senator Graham holds a Ph.D. from the University of Georgia in economics and taught at Texas A&M for 12 years. Phil is an avid hunter, and Joe has hunted many times with him in Maryland, South Carolina, and in Texas. We all took a canoe trip together, retracing a portion of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And I can report that Phil and his lovely wife Wendy's canoe skills became a legendary. It was on this trip that I saw firsthand the passion Phil has for this country, its history, and its people. We knew when we asked Phil over a year ago to speak in this time slot that he would have some unique insights no matter what the outcome of the election. I'm sure this will be the case. So it's my great pleasure to present Senator Phil Graham of Texas.
Oh, thank you, Leslie. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Please go ahead and eat. I didn't get everything out of 18 years in the Senate, but I became accustomed to speaking when absolutely no one was listening. I appreciate having an opportunity to come back. I've been to Naples before, but I didn't get to stay. Y'all have high standards. I didn't resent it, just I didn't meet the standards. This is a wonderful place, and you're very fortunate to live here. I want to talk today about the economy and about the financial crisis, and at least my assessment of where we are. How we got here, I think, is much clearer to me than where we go from here. But I will take a crack at both. And I'll try to talk about all these things in such a way as to deviate from my background, both as a school teacher and as a politician, both professions being inclined to be long-winded. In my mind, our financial crisis really has two roots. One goes back to the recession of 2000-2001. Even today, people do not realize how different that recession was than any other recession in American history. For the first 150 years of American history, we had a series of financial panics. For the second 50 years, we had a series of inventory cycles. But the 2000-2001 recession was produced by a speculative bubble in the equity market that broke and destroyed $6.7 trillion worth of paper wealth. Roughly the amount of destruction proportionately that we are looking at in the market today. And investment collapsed, but consumption never flagged, and home building was at peak conditions in the trough of the recession. And that's critically important to this story, because in every other recession in American history, home building, being very much affected by economic conditions, was always on its back at the trough of recessions. So that when the Federal Reserve Bank cut interest rates, in responding to this recession, they inadvertently stimulated an industry that was already in boom conditions. And as a result, housing prices literally, at least compared to historic standards, exploded. From 2001 through 2006, housing prices in America on average rose by 14.6%. To find any comparable data in American history, you have to go back to the period 1946 to 1951, which was the period in which wage and price controls were taken off. During this period, from 2001 to 2006, before the oil price spike, I think you could make a good argument that if you could adjust for inflation, adjust inflation for quality changes, that prices probably fell throughout that whole period. So that you had a massive increase in the value of American homes. Now, this changed everything about the market that in which houses were bought and sold. First of all, we had gradually been moving from a market where people made loans and held the loan on their book for 30 years to a market where they made the loan and then they sold off the loan to be securitized and then sold all over the world. Obviously, when you're holding a loan for 30 years, you pay attention. When somebody else is going to be holding it for 30 years, no matter how much you try to get people to pay attention, you don't have as much skin in the game, and as a result, the level of focus on lending standards was already declining because of securitization. But now suddenly, with prices rising at over 14.5% a year, it was literally impossible to make a bad housing loan for that five-year period. Because if all else failed, the house could be sold for more than it was purchased for, and the loan could be paid off. So the people who were making loans became more and more forward-leaning and careless. The people who were securitizing the loans responded in a similar way. The rating agencies that were rating the loans, since there was no possibility of default under current circumstances, rated that paper very highly, and the people who purchased it lulled themselves into a false sense of security. And it's easy to understand looking back. Prior to 2007, we had never had a year where we had good data to know where the price of the average American home had fallen. Let me repeat that. We've calculated data from 1946 on, and in not a single year since 1946 has the aggregate mean home price in America fallen prior to 2007. Now, in various parts of the country, there were differences, but the country as a whole has had remarkable stability. Just that fact had a profound impact on people's sense of security. So that was on the supply side of the loan. On the demand side, there was another reason to buy a home, because it was an appreciating asset. And if you could get a house, even if you bought it under conditions that you couldn't pay for it, a year later, it was going to be worth 14.5% more, and you could refinance it. So you had a whole new driving force to buy houses. The market is going to help you pay for it. It is an investment at the same time that it is providing housing services. And in responding to this demand, the market set out in evolving a never-ending stream of exotic mortgages, beginning with a variable rate mortgage, which was common in Europe, but never had been common in America. That's a mortgage where you take interest rate risk by having the rate change based on what happens in the marketplace. And at the end of the process was the reverse amortization loan, where literally the principal went up every year. That was one source of the problem. The other source of the problem was an obsession in American government with home ownership. America has believed, and I think correctly believes, that home ownership is an important part of a stable society. That people that own homes tend to behave differently. I once in 1990 was running for re-election, and I had an opponent who had no dollars and no cents. I did a poll of 5,000 random samples. It's something any statistician would dream about. I identified 256 people that admitted being on welfare. How many of them you think were going to vote for me? Zero. In any case, in looking at that data, I found that the best predictor of people that were going to vote for me was not income, not education, not race. It was, did they own their own home? 82% of people who own their own home were going to vote for me. The second best predictor was, do they work in the private sector? Needless to say, I was high on home ownership. Now, to try to promote home ownership, the American government made it easier and easier and easier to buy larger and larger houses with lower and lower down payments. And it did it through a series of programs, but the most important programs had to do with the two financial giants, Freddie and Fannie. Over time, Congress set quotas for Freddie and Fannie to make loans to lower-income people. And as Freddie and Fannie got in deeper and deeper problems, into deeper and deeper trouble, Congress demanded higher and higher quotas. By the end, by the time we fell off the treadmill, there were two quotas. One quota was on loans to people below the average income by community definition. And the secondary quota was a quota to people who had only 60% of the income of the community in which they lived. The default rate among those loans, needless to say, turned out to be extraordinarily high. So that Freddie and Fannie were mandated to securitize these loans and to hold this paper. Congress passed laws mandating that they do it and setting two different quotas. The second driving force was the politicization of lending in America. And it's interesting. The other day I was having dinner with the chairman of the Agricultural Bank of China. And we were talking about this problem. And he said, you know, bankers in China have no trouble understanding this problem. And I said, well, y'all are obviously pretty damn smart if you don't have any problem understanding this problem. He said, no. He said, 20 years ago, we were forced to make loans. What the Community Reinvestment Act did is it set up a system whereby a bank, in order to get a rating that would allow them to acquire another bank or sell part of their bank or open a new branch, or even put in a new teller machine or take a teller machine out, had to meet CRA quotas. And the easiest way to get the CRA quota was to make subprime loans. In fact, the banks that went out of business first were the banks with the highest CRA rating in the country. So you've got the confluence of these two forces. One, a market force driven by an anomaly in a previous recession. Part of the problem you have when government intervenes in markets is it has unintended consequences. And in fixing that problem, we planted the seeds for the next problem. And secondly, you had a government policy to try to help people buy homes. And people have asked me around the world, tell me in a sentence what caused this problem. And the best I've been able to come up with is we broke the basic rule of banking, which is don't lend people money they can't pay back. So what happened is what always happens. The bubble broke. In 2007, housing prices stopped rising. People who had bought housing based on the assumption it was going up by 14.6%, immediately all of their assumptions were invalidated. People that had made all these loans based on the assumption about price rises were immediately, all of their decision making was invalid, and then prices turned down. In looking at this problem, and I would have to say, I saw part of this problem coming, but not enough to be of great value. I saw the defaults, but what I didn't understand and where I sort of had a false sense of security in my own thinking was the value of these subprime loans relative to housing in general and relative to the capital stock of the nation didn't seem big enough in and of itself to produce a recession. But what I didn't truly understand, and what no one understood apparently, was that these assets were basically being held as assets for financial institutions, and they were all highly leveraged, and so the whole process multiplied the impact. And you need to understand that securitized mortgages in America sell all over the world. When I visit with the Bank of Japan or the Bank of Korea or the People's Bank of China, we don't get to the second point before they're asking me about Freddie and Fannie paper. All over the world, these assets are held. It's part of the miracle of our housing market in that the world finances housing in Naples, Florida. Nice housing. Now, so all of this capital destruction occurred. Banks started to discover it under the new accounting standards. If you write down assets, you mark them to market. And so to sell any was to establish a market, which would require you to mark all the rest of the assets to market. And so we started this process of trying to find this market. I could go on and on in this area, and I don't know whether it's productive, but we got question and answer period. So the bottom line is we have had tremendous destruction of capital, great dislocation in the market, a financial tremor, which is certainly by historic standards very, very significant. I think the comparisons with the Great Depression are greatly overblown. But part of our problem in looking at this problem is that we have lived in a golden age for 26 years. Since 1982, we have had two recessions, and each one of them lasted for 8 months. So in 26 years, we have had 16 months where the economy has not grown. I don't see, or I'm not aware of, any comparable period in the history of the country or maybe of any country, where you had that kind of sustained prosperity. And it distorts our perspective. I was at a meeting several months ago, and somebody just kept jumping up and down. IndyMac, which is a insignificant bank in California, by any kind of comparison, failed. And this guy was making the point, this was the largest bank failure in 20 years. We've had the largest bank failure in 20 years. And finally, I wasn't going to say anything. Finally, I said, well, yeah, but we hadn't had any bank failures in 20 years. You know, when you see the data, consumption fell more than any year since 1982. How many quarters since 1982 do you think consumption has fallen in? None. From 1982 to the third quarter of this year, consumption grew every single quarter. So our perspective, you know, as one wise man, I'm not going to say it. So our perspective has gotten distorted. Now, where are we and what does all this mean? We have a financial convulsion. Where are we in terms of the adjustment? Well, there is some good news. The spreads are starting to narrow. No one knows when the full adjustment will occur. But things are never, at least in the time period that we're focused on, are going to return to normal. Because normal may not have been normal. The level of leverage that financial institutions had, it'll be a long time before that comes back. The business models that worked under that leverage, the independent investment bank, will they ever work in the foreseeable future the same way? Those are questions we don't know the answer to. So I don't know when things will return to normal, and I don't know what normal is. Some good news. Remarkably, the economy is doing better than you would expect it to be doing given what's happening in the financial market. From the second quarter of this year going backwards, the economy grew by 2.1%. It was only in the third quarter in August that we started seeing data that suggested that the economy was beginning to sink. Now, in the media, we had been in a recession or a depression for months. But in reality, the economy held up incredibly well until August. Now, consumption in the third quarter fell by 3.1%. Consumption, 71% of the American economy. So that in and of itself would have sent the economy down by 2.1%. But the economy fell by only 0.3%. Why? Export of goods, export of services. While net foreign and direct investment was negative, it rose dramatically over the third quarter. And government outlays, not stimulus, but just government outlays at all levels, stimulated the economy. Now, I think it is clear at this point that we are going to have a negative fourth quarter, and it could be substantial. Now, the real question, and I'll end with this so I got plenty of time for questions, is where do we go from here? What's going to happen in the economy? Well, I think I can tell you some things that are not going to happen. We are not going to have a 1930s depression. Because what happened in 1929, we had a recession. And then in 1931, we had a financial panic. And the Federal Reserve Bank, which had been put into place in 1911, did everything wrong. And they turned a financial panic into a depression, by letting the banking system collapse and letting the money supply fall. We're not going to make that mistake again. Every central banker in the world knows that story, knows those facts, and so we may make other mistakes, but we're not going to make that mistake. So if you wanted to look at a sort of a normal curve where this is a 1930s type depression, I think you can cut that off and throw it away. So the question is, are we going to have a pre-1982 recession, or are we going to have a post-1982 recession? We had some rough pre-1982 recessions. The 1958 recession was a very tough recession. And I don't know the answer to it. Shakespeare said, the day will end and the end will be known. But I do know that the economy will survive and it will overcome not only the illness but the absurd prescription of the doctor. I do know that if you got a long perspective, if you got a 5-year perspective, I am confident that you're going to be okay in the equity market. The people that have really been hurt by this, since unemployment certainly has risen, but still it's risen from 6.1 to 6.5%, but the real pain of this financial crisis slash beginning of a recession has been for people who are 55 and above and who have depended on their investments for their retirement. And if you're under 55 and you got a good time period, you won't have sad memories of this. It'll just be another thing that worked out. Right now, for those people, it clearly is a traumatic experience. I'm sure somebody will ask me about government policy. What we don't know yet is what is going to be done in the name of fixing this problem. And it's an area where I'm greatly concerned because having studied the Depression, I know that much of what we know about the Depression is not so. And that many things Congress did and laws it changed, like Glass-Steagall, were based on assertions that were never proven. There's a lot of evidence that the breaking up of banking and securities and insurance was a sort of a vendetta against J.P. Morgan. And so I don't know where we go from here. It'll be interesting to watch. But whatever is broken can later be fixed. So with that, let me stop, and I'll stand over here because I have a microphone.
Senator, we want to make sure that you come back and visit us again. So we have here books about Naples and Marco Island.
Great.
And I'll take them and put them at your chair.
Good.
And now Leslie will ask your questions. And I felt sorry for her. I think our table's about to tip for the weight of all the questions that got handed in. And I don't know how she sorted through them this fast.
Well, many of the questions were the same question. Should we bail out the U.S. auto manufacturers? Why and why not?
Well, let me try to explain how we should have explained the intervention in the financial market. What we should have said is, look, this problem will fix itself. We can do nothing, and you'll have a bunch of banks and insurance companies and security companies go broke. And we'll have a sharp, deep recession. It'll last maybe two and a half years, and the system will right itself. Or we might be able, by injecting some liquidity in the system, to shortcut that process and have a reasonably mild, short recession. Why should you think that is possible? Well, we had securitized assets that were backed by mortgages selling at 20 cents on the dollar. Nowhere in America do you find houses selling at 20 cents on the dollar. That was being driven by our accounting system and by the need for liquidity. But nobody ever explained what they were trying to do, much less doing it. And so as a result, it sounds perfectly reasonable. Well, my God, you bailed out the banks at $700 billion. Well, by the time this paper sold, by the time we sell off the stake that's been taken in these banks, I think we will lose money on Freddie and Fannie, but for the banks and insurance companies, I don't know about AIG, but if you lump them all together, it's inconceivable to me that in 2 or 3 years that we won't at least break even on that process. Now, the question is, if you give money to General Motors, are you going to have you got a chance of breaking even on it? And I think under the current circumstances, the answer is no. General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford once had a virtual monopoly with massive market shares, and as monopolists do, they shared that monopoly power with organized labor. And they negotiated benefits for the future they could not pay for. For example, if they lay somebody off in Detroit, they have to pay them for 3 years. They can't, through contract, they can't shut down plants. They've got limits on how much they can produce of component parts abroad. They've got health care benefits that no one else in the private sector has. And yet organized labor is not offering to negotiate any of these things as its part in this process. If the federal government gives them $25 billion under the current circumstances, that $25 billion is simply going to go to pay off all of these deals that the big three have entered into, and we'll be right back trying to do this again. So I would have to say that I subscribe to the school that they've got two choices. One, they can sit down with organized labor and they can fix these problems by basically saying we can't make these payments. So you got two choices. There can be no General Motors. Now, there'll be plenty of automobile jobs. We've got 804,000 jobs in the auto industry that are not at Ford, Chrysler, or General Motors, and they're at companies that are very, very competitive. Like BMW or Toyota or Nissan in America. So we're not talking about not producing American cars. We're talking about not producing them through these three companies. Now, I would have to say, only right behind my guns am I more dedicated to anything than my Suburban. It's going to be the next to last thing I ever give up on this earth. But I am convinced that it will be produced. So here's the deal. They can fix their own problem if they're willing to do it, and we can't fix it no matter what we do through government at this point. If they would really do a lot to fix their own problem, I, for one, would be willing to try to do some things to try to help them. But if they, you know, the government ought to be like the Lord. They ought to help those that help themselves.
Could you comment on the 24/7 coverage of Wall Street, the economy, and every bit of negative news and its psychological impact on the markets?
Well, recovery and good news, the media is a lagging indicator of good news and a lead indicator of bad news. And people in the media are trying to write the next chapter in the last book. And so every bit of bad news fits in the book and every bit of good news doesn't fit in the book. And so I do believe, and it was the worst possible time to have the financial crisis was during the presidential campaign. So what we've done is that, you know, the gloom and doom is palpable. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of gloom and doom. I was whining about it the other day. My son, who's worked for Mellon for 4 years, now he has his own little hedge fund, said, "Pop, did you think it was going to be great every year?" I said, "Hell yes, I thought it was." Anyway, so let me just give you a little fact. Income was up in the third quarter. Consumption fell, but income was up. Why did it fall? Fear. Now, you also had a wealth effect from housing, and that's not an unambiguous wealth effect because people who own houses are poorer, but people that want to buy them are richer. But in the equity market, it's unambiguous. So wealth effect and fear. Confidence is everything. It's one of the reasons you can't redistribute wealth, because you destroy confidence by doing it and you destroy the wealth. So you can destroy it, but it's hard to take it from somebody and give it to somebody else. So, yeah, but it's the fact of the world we live in, and ultimately reality overcomes perception.
With 40% of the people in our country not paying taxes, and most likely 50% in another 4 years, how will a Republican ever win another election?
Well, it does get harder. Well, I think to win another election, you've got to convince people that your policies are about growth and prosperity and not just about taxes. I would have to say on this problem that I am as much a culprit as anybody, and so is Ronald Reagan. Because one of the things we did to get the tax cuts is by raising deductions, we took more and more people off the tax rolls. And I would have to say that it is a little bit, it makes me nervous that you've got so many people who don't have a stake in the funding of government. It's just a cold reality.
This one is from a student. To what degree will the economic situation we are currently in affect financial aid and loan opportunities for college students?
Well, it has affected it to this point because Congress lowered the limits on what you could earn through private lending and created a problem. And then they didn't get blamed for it because the financial crisis took the blame. But that problem is now largely fixed, and I don't think it'll have any effect.
The Democrats in Congress are calling all the CEOs of companies greedy. That's in caps. Aren't they guilty of greed when all three branches of the government in the last election?
Seems greedy to me.
Okay.
Well, you know, look, you can overdo this word greed. And there's a fine line between ambition and greed. And I guess I would try to define it by saying that if you're ambitious to get ahead and you're doing it in the moral constraints, I don't call that greed. But it's one of the buzzwords of American politics today.
If easy credit is the source of the bubble that is bursting, is the current flood of government credit the answer? And what seeds are we planting for the next problem?
Well, you heard my explanation of what I thought the problem was. And the easy credit, in response to that recession of 2000-2001, clearly was a major contributing factor. Looking back, I don't know that we wouldn't have been better off to have left that process to work itself out. because the recession was so different, but politically, not even the Fed felt that it could do that. I don't know what seeds we're planting, but I'm sure we're planting them. And I would have to say that one of the fears I have is that, first of all, I hope that this turns out to be a modest recession or a moderate recession. But I am fearful that we're going to have all these stimulus packages, and most of them are never going to go into effect until the recession's over. Even in 1958, infrastructure spending didn't go into effect until that recession, which is one of the deepest in our post-war history, was over. So I'm worried we're going to get a bunch of stimulus that's going to come after the problem is passed, that we're going to have a bunch of spending based on a belief that you can raise taxes on capital gains and dividends and on high income earners and raise a bunch of revenues. I feel pretty confident in saying I don't think that'll be successful, but once you spent the money, it's hard to get it back. And I think one of the seeds could be in the more distant future, a big financial problem for the government itself.
Do you think the lack of proper supervision helped create the present problems?
Well, here's the problem. Supervisors don't know any more than the people they're supervising. Alan Green, you know, there's an arrogance of government that if you let government control it, that bad things wouldn't happen. Where is the evidence? Alan Greenspan was telling me when he got to the Fed's ability to assess financial risk was minuscule as compared to Lehman Brothers. Well, Lehman Brothers is broke. So the point is, this arrogance that government knows best, I don't think there's any factual basis for it. I don't think there's much of a basis for the argument that it was deregulation. Number one, we hadn't had a whole lot of deregulation. The great deregulator was Jimmy Carter, and I give him great credit for it, and then Ronald Reagan. But it's been few and far between since then. But the people that are making this argument have an agenda. Please always remember this about anybody in politics. They've got an agenda, and anything that happens that allows them to promote their agenda, which they've had since elementary school, they're going to seize. So if your agenda has been having the government run the economy of America, and you lust after that perspective, then you're obviously going to say this was the failure of capitalism. I told you it was going to happen, and you didn't do it, and now capitalism has failed, and I have the answer. We'll put back up the wall in Berlin, and we'll get on the other side of it.
Senator, thank you. That was great.
Thank you.
Those of you who would like to listen to this again will find it on the website later on, the Forum Club's website, and also NaplesDailyNews.com or DailyNews.com. So you'll have a chance to digest it a little more. Once again, thank Senator Graham for a brilliant speech. See you on December 12th.